at least once a year. Community leaders are calling for the British government and police to provide better support and funding to help in safeguarding Muslim minority groups from increasing attacks. According to Britain's Home Office, anti-Muslim attacks made up almost half of religiously motivated hate crimes between 2020 and 2021, and this has stayed largely consistent in recent years. One of the impacted communities was in Finsbury Park in North London, where one man, Makram Ali, was killed and nine others were injured in a terrorist attack in 2017. The chairman of Finsbury Park Mosque, Mohammad Khosbar, said the government, police and local organisations must do more to protect Muslims at risk after his community was one of the many targeted in recent years. On the report, Mohammad Khosbar said, "This is very worrying for the Muslim community and its mosques, as it shows things are going from bad to worse. We're seeing more Islamophobic attacks happen to mosques, institutions and individuals, so it should be taken really seriously, but not only the Muslim community, but by the government and police." The British newspaper The Guardian has more on the story. Calls for a working definition of Islamophobia began in 2019, following the Christchurch mosque shooting in New Zealand, which killed 51 Muslims and caused a 600% surge in Islamophobic incidents in the UK and have continued ever since. British Muslims want the police to take Islamophobic incidents more seriously. They said, "Many times we don't hear feedback or know what's happening with those cases, so at least some of the incidents should result in perpetrators being put to justice, as it will cause anyone thinking of attacking Muslims and attacking mosques to think twice." The Darul Elm Mosque in East Ham in East London faced attacks in April of this year after a group of men armed with bottles and hockey sticks attacked worshippers at the mosque. Nushad Abu Salih Muhammad, one of the trustees of the mosque, described the initial impact and aftermath of the incident. He said, "This has not only physically but emotionally set us back. All the hard work, time and dedication put into establishing a mosque for the Sri Lankan community of East London, a place for our small community to feel safe, seek refuge in and find solace, has all been shattered and taken away from us by one night's act of hatred and abuse. On what needs to be done to protect Muslim communities in their places of worship," Muhammad said, "we need more media coverage, more support and allies, more funding needs to be allocated towards protection of mosques and its users. We also need CCTV, fencing and security guards."
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking, as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbour. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck. And then, if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one customs administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste is crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. Help. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic.
and classify different tabs.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year. But it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guiyu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. Take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. My Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay it ordinarily.
At Tema Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbour controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The economic damage caused by the coronavirus era, the scandals and incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, the economic wrongdoings of the government after Johnson, led by Liz Truss, and the increase in energy and food prices due to the conflict in Ukraine go hand in hand to bring Britain's economy into the longest recession in the past 100 years. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website, thebusinessstandard.com, has more for us. The Bank of England has warned the UK risked being plunged into the longest recession in the past 100 years after it pushed up the cost of borrowing to 3% in the biggest single interest rate rise since 1989. The Bank of England said a 0.75 percentage point increase, the latest in a series of 8 interest rate rises since last year, would not be enough to guarantee victory in the war against double-digit inflation, as it cautioned further action would be needed. Britain's economy faces a very challenging outlook, with a recession that began this summer now expected to last until the middle of 2024. With the possibility of a general election being held in 2024, the Conservatives face campaigning to remain in government at the tail end of a prolonged slump, during which the Bank of England said it expected unemployment to rise from 3.5% to 6.5%. However, there was some relief for mortgage holders as the central bank downplayed city expectations of a steep rise in the cost of borrowing to above 5%, arguing that the prospect of a 2-year recession meant it was likely to take a much less aggressive stance. Andrew Bailey, the Bank of England's governor, said, "We can't make promises about future interest rates, but based on where we stand today, we think the bank rate will have to go up by less than currently priced in financial markets." The last time British rates rose to more than 0.5 percentage point was in 1989. John Major's government was forced into a 2% rise during the exchange rate mechanism crisis in 1992, though for less than 24 hours before it was scrapped. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. The Bank of England now expects inflation, which hit 10.1% in September, to peak at 11% by the end of 2022, and then to fall probably quite sharply from the middle of 2023. It blamed higher energy prices and a tight labour market for the big increase, which matched aggressive rises in recent days by the US Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the ECB. The vote to raise interest rates was split 7-2 among the 9 members of the Monetary Policy Committee after Silvana Tonreiro voted for a 0.25 percentage point increase and Swati Dingra voted for a 0.5 percentage point jump. Both are professors at the London School of Economics. They argued the full effects of 8 consecutive rises should be allowed to feed through into the wider economy before more severe action was taken. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said inflation is the enemy and is weighing heavily on families, pensioners and businesses across the country. That is why this government's number one priority is to grip inflation. And today the Bank of England has taken action in line with their objective to return inflation to target. Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, said families now face higher mortgages and more anxiety after months of economic chaos. Rachel Reeves added, "Working people are paying the price for Tory failure. Britain deserves more than this." On alternative assumptions that interest rates remained unchanged at 3%, the economy would still continue contracting until the end of 2023, but the cumulative fall in output would be 1.7% rather than 2.9%, and unemployment would peak at just over 5%. The Bank of England said it had not factored in any action by Jeremy Hunt in his autumn statement on 17th of November. Though the Chancellor of the Exchequer is expected to announce a package of tax increases and spending cuts worth up to £50 billion. The Reuters news agency has covered the same story from a different angle. The British Retail Consortium, BRC, said on Wednesday, 2nd of November, the cost of fresh food in British shops last month was 13.3% higher than a year earlier, the biggest annual increase in records going back to 2005. The British Retail Consortium, a trade body, said its broader measure of shop price inflation picked up to 6.6% in October from 5.7%, while food prices overall rose 11.6% as the cost of less perishable foodstuffs rose more slowly than prices of fresh items. The British Retail Consortium's chief executive, Helen Dickinson, said, "It has been a difficult month for consumers who not only faced an increase in their energy bills but also a more expensive shopping basket." Britain's official measure of consumer price inflation, which covers a wide range of goods and services including soaring energy bills, returned to a 40-year high of 10.1% last month. And the Bank of England expects it will peak this month at nearly 11%. Outsized rises in the cost of food have come under particularly close attention, and some anti-poverty and anti-obesity charities have reported that shoppers are turning to more calorific processed foods to save money. The British Retail Consortium said retailers were under pressure from rising energy bills, staff cuts and commodity prices, and urged the government to freeze a planned £800 million rise in business property taxes, which shops would pass on to their customers. Helen Dickinson said, "While some supply chain costs are beginning to fall, this is more than offset by the cost of energy, meaning a difficult time is ahead for retailers and households alike." Andy Clark, chair of the Operational Improvement Company, Newton Europe, said Christmas will be challenging for British households who are already facing high fuel costs and rising energy bills. He added, "Everyone wants to enjoy Christmas, but you've got to take a view that certainly for the next 3 to 6 months, we're not going to see any rapid decline in inflation. It's going to be a tough winter, and food inflation is clearly adding to the burden of families."
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. Those who hear the Quran's words, do not weaken or grieve. You shall have the upper hand should you be faithful. Those who hear this amazing reassurance from the Quran only to see that when they look at reality, those who believe in the Quran are no better than anyone else. In fact, they see that they are dependent on everyone else. They are going to wonder what happened to the Quran's promise. And if they do not find any time when this promise was fulfilled, they are going to await the appearance of the 12th Imam, ajjalallahu farajah. They will convince themselves that yes, this promise is true. It will come to pass when the Mahdi appears, and everywhere that faith takes root. However, the faith the Quran is speaking about is a faith that is never separated from duty, because according to the Quran, faith is more than something in one's heart. If assenting to or accepting some beliefs was enough to have this thing we call faith, then I tell you that the first believer in the Prophet was Abu Lahab or Walid ibn Mughira. They were men of intelligence. They knew full well that the Prophet was not lying. They knew he was telling the truth. Do you want proof of this fact? The proof is that they would sit together and plot how to defame the Prophet. They said, "Let's go and listen, see what he says, then point out its flaws." Then once they had gone and listened, they sat together the next night and said, "No, this is not the words of a human being. These are the words of God." So they accepted this fact. They accepted that these words were not emanating from the Prophet, but from God. However, even 14 centuries after this fact, we still don't accept Abu Lahab as a believer. He was not a believer because his belief did not lead him to feel any sense of duty.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So what do you say? If it was enough to know what was true on a theoretical level and to have belief in one's heart, then Amr bin As should be the first Shia in the world. The same Amr bin As who either witnessed the events of Ghadir with his own eyes or heard about it from those who had. You and I can only read about that event in books some 13 centuries later. The same Amr bin As even composed verses of poetry in praise of Ali. Amr bin As who, on his deathbed, at that sensitive moment of a person's life, expressed regret and showed remorse, who said that he had sold his religion for the worldly promises of Muawiyah and fought Ali, even though he knew Ali was right. So, from where I'm sitting, Amr's faith was deeper and more insightful than the Shia of the 14th century, who find out about the imamate of the commander of the faithful and believe in it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
WIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter. Britain is facing a severe energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies. Meanwhile, the Met Office has said that the probability that Britain will face a colder than usual winter is slightly higher than normal. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT had a look on this issue, writing, amid a looming energy crisis, meteorologists say the chances of lower temperatures are 1.3 times higher than normal in Britain. The probability that Britain will face a colder than usual winter is slightly higher than normal, the Met Office said recently in a three-month forecast. As the country braces for an energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russia sanctions and a sharp decrease in Moscow's energy supplies to Europe, meteorologists say there is a 25% chance the upcoming season will be cold, which is 1.3 times the usual chance. At the same time, the Met Office said that the chances of dry conditions are greater than normal, while stormy conditions are less likely than normal. Overall, however, the most likely scenario is that the upcoming winter will be an average one, according to the outlook. October in Britain was unusually warm, with temperatures last weekend going above 20 degrees Celsius. The mild weather means there hasn't been as much a spike in energy demand, and gas prices have actually decreased from their summer peaks. Nevertheless, Britain is preparing for a challenging winter, despite not being directly dependent on Russian energy supplies. The UK used to import gas and electricity from continental Europe during the coldest months and extreme weather events. However, this year, European countries are facing severe energy crises of their own amid attempts to rid themselves of dependency on Russian fuel. Late last month, Centrica PLC announced that it was reopening North Sea-based Rau, the country's biggest gas storage facility, after a five-year suspension. Though it will be operating at only around 20% of its former capacity, it will still add 50% to the UK's reserves. Britain's National Grid, ESO, said in October that its base case remains unchanged, suggesting there will be enough gas and electricity for Britain this winter. However, it didn't rule out a more extreme scenario involving a hypothetical escalation of energy crisis in Europe and a deficit in gas, as well as in electricity supplies. In this case, mitigation strategies are expected to be launched, including dispatching the retained coal units. ESO head John Pettigrew also revealed a worst-case scenario. If the weather turns extremely cold and if gas supplies to feed power stations are insufficient, the company will have to switch off gas and electricity in parts of the country for a few hours at a time. Financial Times also reported the head of National Grid has warned that many British households would find this winter financially very, very hard, despite government support to limit the rise in gas and electricity bills. John Pettigrew, the chief executive of the company that oversees Britain's electricity and gas systems, told the Financial Times he was under no illusions about the struggles many people would face during the colder months, despite a universal subsidy on all domestic energy bills until April. Even with a taxpayer-funded price cap, this is a doubling up of what people are used to paying for their energy bills. Therefore, inevitably, there are going to be people who are going to struggle. The government has capped the unit cost of energy until April, which would mean a typical household would pay about £2,500 on average over a year. But last winter, the equivalent figure was £1,277. Each household will also receive a £400 rebate on energy bills with additional means-tested payments through social security benefits. But charities have warned the help will not be enough to avoid 7 million households, or a quarter of all homes, experiencing dire fuel poverty. Pettigrew said that when the support ended in April, a more targeted scheme to help those households in the most need seemed the best solution. Something like a social tariff makes a lot of sense. Pettigrew's call mirrors that of some big energy suppliers, such as Scottish Power, that have been pushing the government to set up a subsidized social energy package that would apply to the most vulnerable customers. Pettigrew was speaking ahead of the announcement that National Grid was setting up a £50 million fund to cover the next 18 months, which it will distribute to organizations such as the Fuel Bank Foundation and Citizens Advice that assist households struggling with the cost of living crisis. Although National Grid does not supply electricity or gas, it receives a proportion of all bills to pay for the management of the energy grids and oversee the country's electricity and gas systems. These so-called network charges, which are distributed among a number of companies, make up about 10 pair of a domestic bill. Simon Francis of the End Fuel Poverty Coalition said energy companies were fast recognizing they had a moral obligation to step in and help struggling households. Pettigrew insisted that National Grid, which made underlying profits of £4 billion during the year to March 31st, was not launching the fund to try to head off a potential backlash against the energy industry as the cost of living crisis spirals. Pettigrew said the energy price crisis, which was exacerbated by the Russia-Ukraine crisis, was bigger than any one individual company can address. And what we are trying to do is to be responsible and play our part. He, who was paid £6.5 million last year, added that the company in May announced it was returning £200 million to bill payers after generating strong earnings from the import and export of power to other European countries via subsea cables. National Grid in October warned households to prepare for the possibility of rolling blackouts this winter if, in the unlikely scenario, Britain couldn't import sufficient energy from continental Europe during periods of high demand. Pettigrew said the company's base scenario was for the country to have sufficient supplies to meet demand this winter. He added that unseasonably warm this winter in recent weeks had helped countries in the EU to fill their gas storage facilities as there had been less demand for heating purposes.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new report by the Afghan Journalistic Center shows that at least 127 journalists and media workers lost their lives during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Investigations also show that in more than 90% of those cases, the ones responsible for the deaths were not brought to justice. The Association of Afghan Reporters is demanding the International Criminal Court to take a look into the killings. People are also asking the Taliban to stay true to what it has promised and show support towards Afghan journalists. That includes ending impunity for crimes against this group of workers who are constantly under danger in a war-torn country.
The U.S. started the war on Afghanistan and caused devastation and casualties. It should be held accountable for the death of all civilians, especially journalists, in the past 20 years. The International Criminal Court should investigate the killing cases of Afghan journalists and recognize them as international crimes. The families of a slain journalist should be paid compensation. Unfortunately, so far, not a single case has been inspected.
This comes as those 127 martyred journalists have been two honest and dedicated staff, Said Farhad Takaddusi and Habibullah Hussainzadeh, who lost their lives on duty in 2011 and 2017. The relatives and colleagues of the two continue to honor their memory.
Two of our colleagues at Press TV were among the victims of U.S. war on Afghanistan. Syed Farhad in 2011 and Habibullah was martyred in 2017, both on duty and in war incidents. They were so close to me and meant a lot for Press TV and the medium community in Afghanistan. Their loss should not be forgotten.